Welcome to After Hours, an abbreviated After Hours, because you will have some Bears post-game coming on at about 10:30. We're going to continue on and interview some people from the carriage trade, and that will be posted online sometime tomorrow. Ben Anderson, as you know, is the producer of this show, and he's an extraordinarily capable producer. He has also proven to be something of an extraordinary talent scout. Ben goes out. I still am like confused by what he does, but he goes to
these, I don't even know what I do.
You do. I know what you're doing here. I don't know what you do outside of here. But you go to these, you often go and work at these sort of incredible aviation extravaganzas.
Yeah, air shows. Yeah.
Well, but you say air shows to me, and I'm like a city kid locked here. And
okay.
An air show is like when my plane to New York is on time. But they feature vintage planes, and what else do they feature?
You name it in the aviation community, and they do. But
experimental planes?
Experimental planes, active military aircraft, nowadays drones and the hover type aircraft, helicopters.
And this is an incredibly popular, I don't even call it a subculture, but a kind of under the radar kind of, you know, the Tribune isn't writing about, hey, come to the air show here. It's kind of under the radar, so to speak.
It is. I mean, everybody looks up when they see an airplane, but nobody thinks about everything that goes on in the aviation community, and there's a lot out there.
And you discovered, the last time you went up there, and I don't know if you discovered Teresa Eamon at the most recent one in Wisconsin.
It's been a few years.
You've been noticing her at these various shows. Well, let's welcome her to the show, because you're going to do the interview.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Teresa, I hope she's on the line at this point.
I am.
All right. Hi, Teresa.
Great, because Ben is in here. Hi, Teresa. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Hello.
Because Ben is in here being my co-host for a while, but he also is the guy. I wouldn't know how to get anybody on the phone here for $1 million. Welcome to the show. You absolutely fascinate me, because you don't just appear at air shows. You kind of you appear at sort of recreated events of the golden age of the big band and kind of the 40s and 50s.
That's right.
How did you get into that? I don't think you fell into it. How did you find it and discover it? And you certainly, from all the pictures I've seen, you certainly dressed the part, I'll tell you that.
Well, I kind of did fall into it, oddly enough, but I have to go backwards a little bit further to lead us to where we want to get to. So I was listening to all of this kind of music, my mother's old record albums, from the time I was 4 or 5 years old. A lot of what I was listening to was Barbara Streisand and those albums where she redid a lot of the standards.
Sure.
So that was the stuff that I was listening to as I was growing up.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Reading, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Which is home to the world's largest World War II air show, which is basically, it's more of a World War II experience that also has an air show with it.
Interesting. Interesting.
And it was through that my father was volunteering at the museum, and my dad is a great guy, but he has a reputation for telling tales.
Okay.
And he was telling all of these people about his daughter who could sing, and she was really good, and this was coming up on 20 years ago, and finally they got tired of him, and they invited me to come out, and they got a pizza parlor to sponsor me.
How old were you at the time, and how scared were you?
20. I was just in my mid-30s. I wasn't afraid so much because I had been singing this stuff for a long time. Because at that point, I was living in Idaho Falls, Idaho.
And what in God's name were you doing there?
Oh, please do tell him.
Now, it's really beautiful there. But I thought the same thing when I moved there. And once I got there, I was like, this is fabulous. I'm a cold weather person, so the weather itself didn't bother me. And I was like an hour and a half from Jackson Hole and 2 hours from Yellowstone. It was heaven.
Hey Teresa.
It was really hard to get to these shows from there.
What industry were you in when you were in Idaho?
Just living.
You can tell us whatever secrets you and Ben share at the air shows. Go ahead. How did you make a living?
I was singing. I had started to sing So I had kind of stopped singing in my 20s and spent a lot of time listening. And I had two small children and had decided that that was their time. And when they got a little older and could spend more time with their dad, then I started singing at local restaurants. And that was where my dad got the idea, well, you should come out and do this air show.
So I had started to
build this singing thing again. It started at a karaoke event.
Don't they all? Yeah. Maybe Barbara Streisand didn't start singing karaoke, but many people, that is where they start.
That is. But I had been trained. I'd been classically trained in high school. I started voice lessons at 14.
Wow.
But then I, you know, typical artist.
Sure.
I had a little trouble focusing on what it was I wanted to do and getting there and stumbling and making a lot of mistakes and having to fix them. So I sort of started getting my musical act together in my late 20s, early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I end up at this air show and thank goodness all these reenactors were like, you know, you really need to dress the part. And so they'd loaned me clothes. And
some of your dad's friends just happened to have these beautiful, like, 40s era skirts and blouses in their closets.
Yes. Yeah, so the World War II weekend has probably 2,000 reenactors, which are people that have all that stuff.
Wow.
So when I went there, there were racks of vintage clothing, and the question was just, could you fit into it? Because women then were a lot thinner than women now.
Yes.
And 20 years ago, I was a lot thinner then than I am now. And I found a couple of outfits and learned how to quickly do the makeup. And so I was singing out in a corner, and all of a sudden people are like, oh my gosh, Jim wasn't kidding.
Jim, you were right. This is the only true story you've ever told us, Jim.
Clearly you know my dad. just kidding.
I'd like to know your dad. I'd like to know your dad.
He is very entertaining. He's a great guy. And I really owe all of that, everything that I'm doing now, to him for getting me started. Because the next year then, I got a much better venue. And in a couple of years, it became... I was kind of the headliner. And then I picked up two shows at the Military Aviation Museum in Virginia Beach.
Mm.
And it was at Reading that Ben and my friend Connie Bolin heard me sing and started the gears rolling to get me out to Oshkosh. And
so Ben is not Ben is not so,
except
so,
for Connie well, what she wanted.
So the great thing, Ben, you are not just a radio producer and an aviation wizard, you are also now an entrepreneur on the level of Colonel Parker, who was
Elvis.
Well, but I think it's great that you discuss. What was it about Teresa? She's a very good singer. I've heard her sing. I've seen photos, but it must be the whole package.
It's the whole package. You just gotta see Teresa in person. It's mind blowing.
Wow.
That is so crazy, because I'll be honest, I am so insecure every time I sing. So when I hear you say that, I'm like, who are you talking about?
Who is this?
I appreciate you saying that.
Well, the insecurity, though, Teresa, as you can imagine, is part of any, you know, I'll bet, maybe not Sinatra, but I'll bet Streisand even has a moment of insecurity before she gets on stage, because you were putting yourself out there in a very abject and bold and unadorned way. You may be in a costume, but it is nevertheless you out there. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
And these songs, the songs from this era, really are the full package. And so when you're singing songs like Round Midnight, if you've been through the emotions that the lyrics are trying to say, and you can sell that, it is an emotional
You're
exposing your heart emotionally, and you, that's a, if you're doing it right, then it is the whole package thing.
No question.
So when I see people crying because of whatever song I'm singing brings back memories, or it's sold the emotion or whatever, that's when I'm really moved and it keeps me going.
We are going to hear Teresa Eamon sing after a short commercial break, and we're going to keep her on here for about another half hour, if that's okay with you, Teresa, because you are now under the wing of Ben Anderson, entrepreneur, producer, extraordinaire. He's like Mike Todd. Mike Todd, you guys don't even know who Mike Todd is.
There'll be no living with him after this.
What? Hey, you don't have to live with him. I have to work and live with him. So thanks for carrying on, Teresa. Just hang on a couple minutes. But I will tell you to watch Mike and Joe, Mike Mater and Joe Donlan, weeknights on WGN TV News at 9. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan, and my producer, co-host, Ben Anderson, and our guest, the one and only Teresa Eamon, who has a fascinating career. I know you've been listening for the last 10 minutes or so. Teresa, you have a sort of website, sort of ReverbNation.com/Teresa Eamon. That's E-A-M-A-N and Teresa with a T-H. Why don't you have your own website? Because I think you're a grand talent and you're under the wing of Ben Anderson. You should have your own website by now, shouldn't you?
Well, I probably should, but the Reverb Nation site actually does quite a bit for me as far as networking and allowing me to see other gigs and things that are coming my way. They also offer all kinds of opportunities for auditioning and things.
Oh, interesting. Good. Good.
Yeah. So there are some real benefits to having that, and it's all kind of what you see.
You also can sample some of your music on there too, which I have done.
And events are on there, and like if I put an event on Reverb Nation, then it hits all of my other social media with one thing. So while it is a little bit cumbersome, the trade-off is I can do it on an app on the road, and it updates everything.
Well, and the other trade-off is it's working for you. So what?
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's working for you. Do you have aspirations, or do you perform beyond the events where Ben Anderson is likely to go, beyond these kind of, are you, I know that's your comfort zone, and I know that those songs in that era you have become incredibly adept at, but do you aspire to, or do you play, or is your dad out there saying, hey, my daughter wants to play at this hip-hop club, or whatever, you know what I mean?
Heavens no.
I will pay money to see hip-hop. Teresa at a hip-hop club. I will pay money for that one.
But you have found that you
have aspirations to sing bigger and have my music heard by more people.
Yeah.
I would like to perform with more live musicians than I've had. Although, you know, when I go to, in particular, there's an air show in Virginia Beach I go to, and there's an amazing big band full of retired military guys, and we always joke that it's our one practice a year. They throw the music down, start playing, and I start singing, and sometimes it's great, and other times it's a train wreck. But I really enjoy the challenge of that and performing with those musicians. I can sing other stuff.
I'm sure you can.
Okay. It's okay, but I'm one of these people whose voice was born for this kind of music.
How interesting. I know there are jazz singers I know in Chicago who also feel the same way.
Yeah.
And it's not like, oh, these are really, and some will make the excuse, oh, these are the greatest songs ever written. And I could absolutely agree with that. Ben, you've seen these people come in.
Yeah.
They are so much more comfortable because they can get inside, I think, and you were just talking about it in the segment before, your ability to sort of get inside the emotion of various tunes and transfer that to audience members.
Yeah.
Now, Ben can tell you that, pardon me, I've had to expand out a little bit because the planes have changed to a degree because of the aging out of the veterans.
Right.
And so, for example, at Air Venture, there's a lot more Vietnam and Korean planes. Yeah. And so I sing Patsy Cline, for example, and I do a little bit of all people, Aretha Franklin. And I'm telling you right now, I don't do any of those. I don't do any of her music justice. I don't claim to. It's a very white version. But Ben can tell you whether it's any good or not.
Well, you could dip into the Doors. I know you don't sound anything like Jim Morrison, but you could certainly dip into that's really interesting how you do have to alter that as the veterans of World War II. My father was one, not a flyer, he's a Marine, but as they begin to pass away.
And what I love, Teresa, is I understand what you're saying, having been fortunate enough to see you perform live, but to see you dip into those other, you know, other decades of music and genres, I wouldn't say that you don't do it justice. It's not the original genre style, but it is a fantastic rendition of your style.
Yeah.
And that's what I love seeing when you perform.
Let's hear something. We have a, Teresa, we have a, Ben has a CD here. We'll try to have Aubrey Mumpower, the world's greatest engineer, the world's greatest engineer, play one of the songs. You might as well, we don't know what's on the CD. Aubrey,
we're going to play
CD.
Teresa Roulette right now. Because I don't have the track listing for your CD.
Oh, okay.
So, we'll play something, and you'll tell us about it.
Okay, great. Thanks.
It'll probably be the worst one.
Oh, it will not. It will not.
On a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. If your like dreamers do. Fate is kind.
Teresa Eamon, that is just beautiful, I must tell you.
Thank you.
Teresa Eamon, who sings at places all around the country. Have you ever performed in Chicago anywhere? Like the Air and Water Show? I don't think the Air and Water Show has.
No, unfortunately,
they don't.
No, I tried out for America's Got Talent, though, and didn't get a slot at Navy Pier.
That's their problem.
You were too good.
That's their problem. They said,
you were too good. That's what happened.
No, they said, she's got too much talent. We can't have her on the show. These are all aspiring artists. How do you, Teresa Eamon, if I can ask, I certainly know you get paid for your various appearances. How do you make a living?
So I am the typical musician. I have done a myriad of jobs in my lifetime. I was a morning DJ for a while in Idaho Falls.
Neat.
That's what I was trying to get you to say earlier.
So that was a really hard job.
She knows our world.
It's hard. Well, we'll get into more of that just after we at this regular station in Chicago have to take a break and hear some news. But we'll hear you sing again, and I want to talk to you some more, as do I want to talk to Ben about his plans for your career. His plans for your career. Welcome back. We have a few more minutes with Teresa Eamon, who I wish was coming to Chicago to perform, because I'm quite taken with her singing and with her personality. Teresa, Ben, you wanted to ask Teresa something?
Yeah, Teresa, because I know... The song we played, I believe there's a really good story behind that, correct?
Yeah, there is, actually. That is the very first song I ever recorded.
Wow.
In a studio. And it was recorded in Idaho Falls, and they had a really great sound guy that I worked with at the radio station I was at. And he had a studio in his basement, and I recorded that song in the closet that he had converted into a sound room. So I was like, that's the day I came out of the closet. And we were doing a level check. So just checking to see, you know, if the levels were all right. And so I sang the first part, and I said, okay, you want me to stop? He goes, no, keep singing. And he went back in, and he took all of that out, and that is a one take.
Wow!
Shot.
Congratulations! Congratulations
on
that. So
that is the song, and I don't listen to any of my CDs because I pick them apart too much. But I will listen to that song, and I can honestly say there's not a lot I would change about that recording.
That's fabulous. That's a rare perfection. That's a rare thing. Where are your upcoming I know you can people can get it when they go to, as they should, reverbnation.com/Teresa Seaman. That's T-H-E-R.
No F.
Yeah, no.
Teresa Eamon.
Eamon. And I'm reading the whole thing. If you read it, that's how I read. It's yeah, like name. It's like there. Yeah, it's not complicated. T-H-E-R-E-S-A-E-A-M-A-N. And you can.
It is a festival
see,
of vowels.
See, it is. Yes, it is. It's a great crossword. Were you get to the time where it's a New York Times crossword puzzle clue answer. You are performing. You have some upcoming performances in October, yes?
I do. So I'll be back at the Military Aviation Museum. And that show is actually a World War I show.
Wow. What do you sing? What do you sing for that over there?
Well, yeah, that's one. And there are a couple of songs that, even though they are World War II, they're known for the World War II period, were actually written during the very end of the World War One era.
Good point.
There's not a lot of World War One songs I can do because a lot of those songs were like group songs, so I try to stay as close to that time period as I can.
Interesting.
But I wear the costumes.
Huh?
I wear the flapper costumes.
So, Teresa, the event is called Biplanes and Brews. Is that correct?
It is. It started out as a World War One show, because they have a grass runway there. And it was tough because if you have more than a slight puff of wind, those World War One planes don't fly.
Yeah, they're like kites or something.
If it rains or whatever. So they turned it into kind of an Oktoberfest, and maybe we'll do some flying too while we're at it. and so far it's worked out really well for them. That now that it's not really an air show, the weather's been great.
Teresa Eamon, you must have in playing all of these various air shows and meeting all of these remarkable veterans, you must have really developed a deep appreciation for them and what they did. Yes,
they are amazing, and I've been fortunate enough to meet some of the best of the best. So I can honestly say I have a good friendship with Colonel Bud Anderson, who's a triple ace. And the stories that he tells when you're least expecting it are the things that really move you and make you understand the level of sacrifice that these men gave. Even if they didn't give their life, they gave a huge portion of their younger years to go and possibly be killed. And they did the most amazing things with airplanes that people at that point didn't really know a whole lot about. I mean, it was only 20-some years after we started flying?
Yeah.
And
I mean,
but
when you think about that.
I would say, and Bud will leave you riveted with his stories, because he will tell you some of these remarkable tales of heroism, and then he will have you rolling in laughter a few minutes later with some of the outtakes. They is.
And nobody loves a margarita like Bud.
Yes.
I mean, and then you can really get some great insight. But, you know, Ben and I have been fortunate enough to meet Dick Cole. And then there are a ton of other lesser known pilots from World War II, Korea, and even up to, you know,
shuttle astronauts.
And they're all amazing people who are willing to give their life for the rest of us, and it is a privilege to get to know them and to entertain for them. And Bud in particular has a favorite song, which is "I'll Be Seeing You." And there have been times, in fact, there was a time this year where they told me I had to cut the set, and it was for Bud's set, and I said, "I'm not done till I sing 'I'll Be Seeing You,' and that's next." And I didn't finish my set until I sung his song for him, because at this point he's in his mid-90s, and you just don't know if this is the last time you're going
to
see these guys.
As we say goodbye to you formally, maybe Aubrey Mumpower will be able to find, I'll be seeing you, and we will close off that thing with that. You know, what you're just saying is you are performing for an audience that collectively, I know there are families involved, but the mostly men who flew these planes, I mean, that they are in possession of the right stuff, as Tom Wolfe called it, and it's a mysterious and alluring quality. There's no quite, and a courageous too quality about them.
It's true. Yeah. And we were lucky 2 years ago, they had the female pilot, her name was Penny, and I can't remember her last name now, mm-hmm. that flew one of the jets during 9/11.
Wow.
And if you ever have a chance to look her up, the story will make the hair on your arms stand up.
Well,
so
I cannot wait.
Men, but now it's women too.
I cannot wait a year or two when you with your producer Ben are playing the United Center or someplace like that. And I try to get
awesome.
And I try to get you back on the air, and you go, "Oh, we don't have time for you. We don't have time for you,
oh,
Teresa." I'll be watching your career
way too long.
And anytime you'd like to come back on the air would be fine with me. You're a great singer, and you're a charming.
I would say we might have to have her on after a couple events she and I have coming up, because we both have aviation stuff coming up in October.
Sure, so, I'd happily.
Yeah. We do.
Well, yeah. Ben, you can come on. You can both come on.
When I go to Oshkosh, I always drive, because I drive from North Carolina, so it's an 18-hour drive.
Oh. You have to go through Chicago.
Yeah.
I cannot wait to meet you. Ladies and gentlemen, here she is once again, Teresa Eamon.
I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree, and I feel like I'm clinging to a cloud. I can't understand, I get misty just holding your hand. And a thousand violins begin to play. It might be the sound of your hello, that music I hear. I get misty the moment you're near. You can say, I wonder through this wonderland alone, never knowing my right foot from my left, my hat from my glove. I'm too misty and too much in love. In love, I'm too
be back momentarily, and we'll get on the telephone the legendary Chicagoan J.C. Gable, now living in Los Angeles, but coming back here for a big, big book and show about the 1968 Democratic Convention here. Y'all remember that? Welcome back with me, Rick Hogan. This slightly abbreviated show because of the Bears game, but some, I don't know, 20 years ago was when I met J.C. Gable. I can't remember, but this was one of the most talented and creative young people I have ever encountered in Chicago. Now lives in L.A., and he's got a publishing company, and he's got a lot of other ventures. And J.C. Gable, it is great to talk to you again. J.C., are you on the phone?
Not me.
We're getting you on the phone.
Okay, I think I'm just on hold. Perhaps
no, you're no. I think well, can you hear me?
I can,
and I can hear you.
Okay, so we're good.
We're
Thank
good.
You for having me, Rick.
Did you hear that? Those praiseful words I said about you.
Oh God, it was. I'm very touched.
No, you really. Well, don't be touched, but you really were. And the fact that you know, Chicago wasn't as hospitable to you as it might have been. Maybe we can make it up this week when you come back with a book and a fantastic exhibition of photography, all under the banner of Chicago 1968, The Whole World is Watching, a book and photo exhibition featuring the work of Terry Southern and Michael Cooper. J.C. Gable, this is done by your, and you, people, you should go to this hatandbeard.com site to see what J.C. has been up to for the last couple of years. How did this book come together, J.C.?
That's a great question. Well, to be honest, Meg Handler, who's a friend of mine, who still lives in Chicago, who's a longtime photo editor. She was at the Village Voice, rest in peace, for many years.
No kidding, rest in peace.
And she and I were talking about trying to do something for 68. And sure. At one point, the Gage Museum on Michigan Avenue, which is, I believe, part of Roosevelt University, mm-hmm. was going to lend us their space. And I picked up this book just kind of at a secondhand shop, which you may remember because you're of age. But it was called Chicago 68, Telling It Like It Was. And it was basically a paperback sure, original that came sure. out in 69.
Sure.
And it was all the reportage from all the different journalists who were parachuted into town to cover the convention.
There were a bunch of interesting journalists that parachuted into town. I mean, among them, Terry Southern, Norman Mailer, Jean Genet,
Bill Styron.
Sure, right.
Elizabeth Hardwick.
Right.
And then, of course, there were some people on the left, you know, like Tom Hayden and some of the people on the counterculture side who were writing for these alternative publications. You know, I had known Abe Peck, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, I've known Abe forever. He wrote the introduction to this book, too, and it's a very stylish. You know, Abe's been a professor and a magazine guru for the last, like, 15, 20 years at Northwestern, and he turned it on for this. I was terribly impressed by his introduction to this book.
I think it put him back in his youthful shoes. He signs off basically saying, you know, my first piece was in the Chicago Seed under the pseudonym Abraham Yippee.
Well, Abe is famous. One of the great footnotes in history, as you know, J.C. Gable, he is the guy who formally applied to the Park District for permits for the Yippies to sleep in Lincoln Park a couple days before the convention. That request was turned down, hence the battering some of those people took in Lincoln Park before the convention started. So back to this whole thing. You got the idea to do this. This photo editor friend of yours tried to put you together with Roosevelt University, and then you picked up a copy of the book and said, wait a minute.
Yes, telling it like it was. And we were going to try to incorporate all that, but then it got better because I'd known Niall Southern, Terry's son. I never got to meet Terry, unfortunately, because I was too young. And he died in the mid-90s, so I was maybe just about of age where I could have possibly have met him, but Niall had contributed regularly to Stop Smiling, the magazine that, you know, when I first met him 20 years ago, yep. that I had started.
And he told me,
he's like, oh, you know, my father brought Michael Cooper, who shot the Beatles,
Rolling Stones,
Lonely Hearts Club, yeah. and the Rolling Stones albums. You know, he came to 68, and I'm like, really? Because I had been already researching, and I found nothing. You know, I mean, I saw Mary Ellen Mark. There were a lot of, just like there were a lot of journalists, Rick. There
sure,
were a lot of photographers sure. in town as well who were there to capture, you know, what, of course, you know, that year was a boiling point, not just in the U.S., a touch point all over the world. You know, in America, especially with, you know, Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy having been killed several months beforehand. I mean, You know, what's interesting to me is, not having been alive at the time, and I suppose you were there.
Yes, I was.
You know, it's like, it not only was the first convention that was basically broadcast with the early yep. remnants of our 24-hour news channel, but, you know, my friend Morgan Neville made a film called Best of Enemies, which is about ABC not having enough money to have people on the ground like Dan Rather at CBS, and I forget who they had, Chancellor maybe at NBC, on the ground. So they put Gore Vidal and Buckley on TV to fight it out, and that created pundit culture in a way. Yeah,
exactly. No question. Well, the whole phrase, JC, the whole world is watching, was the result of the knowledge that this was being broadcast across this country. Maybe not the whole world, but right. certainly the country was seeing what was going on in the streets of Chicago. So you got in touch. You got in touch with yes. with Naya. He told you about Adam Cooper saying, "Oh my God, the photographs of his dad are available." Had they met? Had they collaborated together on anything? They are the editors.
They're the editors of the book. I mean, this is frankly, Rick, this was something they had dreamed about doing for years.
Yeah.
We didn't have this scheduled at all, and we kind of stopped everything about 90 days ago and said we have to do this. I immediately called Pete Tolson and Cody Hudson, who are friends of mine, who are now very successful restaurateurs in town. They have Longman and Eagle, Parsons Chicken and Fish, a bunch of those restaurants and bars in the new Athletic Association. You know, I can't even keep up with it, but
right,
they
no
have
kidding.
Become restaurateurs and then Rosario's, as it were. And I knew they had this new alternative art space called Land and Sea Department, which is ostensibly this huge warehouse out by Garfield Park.
Yep.
And I called them and said, hey, could we stage some sort of exhibition there at some point at the end of the summer? And Cody then sends me a picture of him in his studio with his, I'll send it to you tonight, Rick. It's great. And it's just like big lettering behind it is 1968. And then he's got a 1968 tattoo.
How fantastic.
It couldn't have been. And, you know, I
well, the serendipitous, the kind of this whole the serendipity of it, JC, is what appeals to me. The opening night of this, and you sent me a little video clip of what it's going to look like. It's a fabulously designed exhibition. It opens Friday, September 14th at 7 to 9 o'clock at the Land and Sea Department, 3124 West Carroll, near Garfield Park, also near the Chicago Teachers Union headquarters. And you will have there, you're going to have a formal presentation that night, JC?
Yeah, Niall's going to be there. We couldn't get Adam in. I know these two are going to come on the air.
Yeah, they are.
But we couldn't get Adam here from Buenos Aires last minute, but because this show's going to three other cities, Rick, I wanted to start it in Chicago. And to be honest, we tried to do it the weekend of the actual anniversary, but that was leading into Labor Day. And as you know, everyone's probably
going. Well, and it was also everybody, you know, the other great thing about this is such a unique look at the convention of 68 through the words of Terry Southern. If you don't know who Terry Southern was, go look him up. This is one of the most distinctive writers, not just of the 60s and 70s, but of the entire century. And Michael Cooper's work is so intrigues me because Michael Cooper was a big, big, big time photographer, but he was in essence, JC, coming here to cover what people imagined was going to be and what in many ways looked like a war.
Yes, and I think, well, it's great that you brought it up in that context because in typical Terry Southern, Michael Cooper fashion, you know, Michael had gotten to know Terry when Terry was in London throughout the 60s while he was working on various films. And Michael at that point was first a Vogue photographer and then at the famous Fraser Gallery, which was the first kind of contemporary pop art gallery in London, sort of at the same time as the Ferris in L.A. and a lot of the stuff going on in New York. And so they had sort of struck up a friendship. But Terry runs into Michael Cooper randomly. He's rolling into L.A. in 68 with the Stones. And this is their first trip to Joshua Tree, which happens a little bit later. But, you know, they run into each other at the bar. And Terry tells him about the assignment at Esquire, about Genet and Burroughs and him. And Ginsberg's already going to be there. And, you know, the MC5 are playing in, you know, whatever, you know, Linkin Park
yes.
or something, hooked up to a hot dog machine for power. And, you know, and Michael just said, I have to go there. And this was the era, which you lived through, where you just go to the airport and walk up to the gate and get a ticket and go.
Get on a plane.
And he just went.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even the Esquire photographer at all. He just kind of was like, oh, I got to go to this. This sounds insane. I'm going. But then he was totally crushed when he got there, because, and I'll let Adam speak to this.
Sure.
But because they beat up all of our children, basically,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And it was shoot to kill and whatever. There's some really funny quotes from Mayor Daley Sr., you know, about the police are there to preserve disorder.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of this stuff is, you know, obviously, like, in the history books. You know, I have to say, too, as a side note, the first 100 people that are coming on Friday night get a special Field Notes notebook. They're our sponsors for this. They make notebooks. They're in town. They make
Jim Kudo, man. Jim Kudo, one of the great ideas of all time, Field Notes brand. They're the greatest notebooks in the world.
I'm glad you know him. I mean, they just got in touch. I didn't even know him. I was a fan. I took a picture of, because I used their notebooks for my stuff. And, you know, so they came on board, and then we're also reproducing. I went to Haskell Wexler's Widow and also Paramount Pictures. We're going to have 100 copies of the coat poster for the film Medium Cool, which is shot on the, you know.
Yeah, Haskell Wexler, one of Stud Circle's best friends, good old Haskell.
Yeah, so,
you're also going to have some of the prints at this exhibition are going to be for sale, yes?
Yes, we're actually selling everything. There's 21 prints for sale. It's going to move to Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York next. But we had open in Chicago. And, you know, I have to say, this is sort of a first book in a series of things we're calling the quote Midwest Initiative, which is ostensibly me going to different archives with various friends and finding all sorts of stuff tucked away. Now, this stuff happened to be in Buenos Aires, where Michael Cooper's son Adam has lived for the last 25 years.
You'll find stuff. But, you'll find stuff here, JC.
Yeah,
I have no doubt.
There is. And we're not just doing Chicago. We're going to do the whole Midwest. So, you know, Rob Elder, who's a mutual friend of ours, got a book about an obscure artist named Gilbert Wilson, who's obsessed with Moby Dick. And we have, you know, a kind of a little capsule on him, which will come out in the spring. You know, he made a film eventually, which is early stop animation that was led into Cannes. And, you know, he lived in Paris and Mexico City and studied with Diego Rivera. And he's very much in that school of thought of the Charles Benton kind of style of sort of that 30s, like sort of WPA era socialist kind of art. Anyways, this guy was living in Terre Haute, which, you know, where he grew up. He was openly gay in the 30s in Indiana.
That's
which
tough.
Is where, you know, the,
that's
which is
tough.
The, where
that's
the
a,
KKK
that's
was
a tough
born,
life,
you know? I mean,
yeah. You're not doing a lot. You're not doing a lot of dating if you're openly gay in the 30s in Indiana, for God's sake.
Hell no.
J.C. Gable, it is so good to talk to you. We got to take a commercial break, and then we'll come back and we'll try... We don't have to take a commercial break. Aubrey's telling me we're not taking a commercial break. There's no news. There is news. We're going to get some news. That's why we're stopping J.C. Gable. It's really great to talk to you. You are as enthusiastic as ever. Welcome back to the show. I know you may be, you know, or would have thought maybe, oh, I'm up to my ears in 1968 reminiscences, and you might have been because there was some real junk published around the anniversary of that tumultuous Democratic convention in August of 68. But whether you are or not, Chicago 68, The Whole World is Watching, which is a book and photo exhibition opening formally next Friday and running through October 14th at the Land and Sea Department, at 3124 West Carroll, is worth your time because it features the work of two, I'm going to say, geniuses. Adam Cooper, a photographer originally out of London, and Terry Southern. I am grateful to have on the phone Terry Southern's son, Niall Southern. Niall, how are you?
Hello, Rick.
You're
great
in Boulder, Colorado.
Thank you.
Your father was a great hero of mine, just a great and tremendous writer. When J.C. Gable calls you and Adam Cooper and says, hey, I want to do a book. And J.C. is always enthusiastic. Hey, I want to do a book. I want to put together a book about this. Had you and Adam thought about doing that before?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the shoe was actually on the other foot. I mean, we were both wearing the same shoe, and we didn't know it, so to speak. Shoe dropped right between us, made a small seismic eruption. And, you know, I called J.C. out of the blue. We had spoken before about some of his other projects going on, and I'm always a J.C. fan, and I'm ready to jump into whatever he's got.
And J.C., with all admiration, there are always J.C. Gable projects going
on. That's right.
Yeah. That's why I love this guy.
Yeah. Amazing. And so Adam and I had pretty much fully worked out the book. But then when JC got involved and said he would do it, which was, of course, music to our ears, because
sure.
you can imagine in the establishment culture trying to get a just-in-time, you know, agitprop almost, certainly radical history book out, you know, they had no, the commercial publishers or even the ones who promoted themselves as a little different, yeah, just couldn't handle it. JC went out on the edge as, you know,
as
I mean,
he is wont to do,
frankly,
yeah.
too.
Well, but the other thing
saying
is...
saying that he'd drop everything or sort of make time stop and somehow pull it off, including, as Adam brought to bear, this exhibition component, which Adam's been doing, you know, practically in his sleep now for years with his father's amazing photographs of the Rolling Stones and the whole, you know, in swinging London scene. So Adam and I teamed up with JC to produce this book. And then, as JC was saying, this book, Telling It Like It Was, I also was drawn to that as a way to really relook at this history from all these amazing people who were there and glean the real nuggets of their observations. And so that's included in our book, and also in the exhibition as well are some of these great quotes from what has been written before.
Sure.
So thank you for, you know, it was great listening to you and JC talking just a moment ago. You guys are...
Well, it's a mutual mutual admiration society on our part, too. I mean, I have admired this kid for a long time, and this book is... you know, I was there. I was working in the basement of the Hilton during the convention, one of my first job I ever had. I'm 16 years old, and watching the chaos in the street where people who look exactly like me but a couple years older are in deep trouble. One of the things in revisiting this, both of you, and I know JC, you were too young, and I guess Niall, you were too young. You certainly weren't there. But in revisiting it through the eyes of your father and also these incredibly talented other writers, how did your impression of the 68 convention alter, JC?
Thank you for letting me go first. Well, obviously, I was not born yet, but I think that book was my first window into, oh, wow, what I was sort of learned in school or whatever in high school about this isn't really the full story. It was sort of the sanitized, you know, whatever, mid-century American version of things. And, you know, being a big fan of the independent press and being someone who's worked in the independent press most of my life, you know, it sent me down a few wormholes.
Sure.
I remember revisiting Apex's wonderful book, Uncovering the 60s, which is kind of a history of that time. And then, you know, the serendipity, you nailed it, Rick, of just the, you know, me and Meg kind of looking for something to do about 68.
Yep.
And then Niall and, you know, and I recently become good friends with this photographer who ran around with Michael Cooper in the 60s and was actually engaged to James Fox, who was then, you know, in performance, the Nick Rogue film with Mick Jagger. And so she had been telling me about Adam, not specifically about this 68 project per se, but it was like a bug in my ear, like, God, I've got to call Adam at some point and sort of see what we could get going together. And then, you know, the serendipity of the whole thing, I think initially, Niall and Adam, I think, were sort of thinking more of a paint-by-numbers book about this and being more historical about it. But with our time restraints, I think we really honed it in. So it was like this kaleidoscopic view, mainly through what Michael Cooper's photographs and Terry Southern's reportage, with like Niall just said, there's kind of a potpourri of all these different other voices, Genet, Elizabeth Hardwick, Mailer, you know, everybody that was in town, Hunter S. Thompson, I don't think he's in the book, but, you know, everyone kind of was in 68. If you were a journalist, you somehow got
Jimmy Breslin
to go to
Breslin.
Yeah, Breslin is there. Yep.
Yeah.
You know,
everybody wanted the 68.
I think that kaleidoscopic way is the best way to look at it because, you know, one person, whether it was Norman Mailer or, you know, Jimmy Breslin, could not be in all places at all times. You're... One's perspective, even if it was the greatest journalist in the world, was the perspective from wherever that journalist was standing or watching. And the whole world, the whole world, a lot of people were watching the whole thing. And you need that kind of kaleidoscopic gathering to even come close to understanding what happened there. When you, Niall Southern, saw the images of Michael Cooper, were they searing for you? Were they disturbing for you? They are everything, I think. Any photographer would be proud of this kind of oeuvre. But how did you react?
Well, you know, I was familiar with a few of the images that were really iconic. You have William Burroughs and my father, Terry Southern, Jean Genet, Allen Ginsberg, all sort of phalanx of resistance, but just casually actually walking across a bridge daylight towards, you know, what they didn't quite know would be just terrible oppression and violence. I think they had an inkling, but so I was familiar with some of the images that are now iconic in that way, and that's one of the great things about Michael's photography. He's got iconic photos that you'll never forget, including the cover of Sergeant Pepper's.
Sure.
Right? That's all emblazoned.
That would be a biggie.
That'd be a biggie. but he also has, as you see in this book, a tremendous range of just capturing the human drama. And as you guys were talking about before, this was a war environment, but Cooper was not a war photographer.
He was very much a
peaceful guy.
Yep.
He was sort of the classic British, you know, I mean, you'd call him a peacenik, but that's a sort of an American, nomenclature. But he was like an original, just a groovy guy who everybody loved. And he would be snapping away, whether it's Marianne Faithfull or Twiggy or Andy Warhol. Everyone was comfortable in his presence and knew that he was just after a connection to the human aspect and no fluff.
Yeah.
So you get that in these pictures. And I'll just say that my own recollection of 68 was looking at my father on the television set. You know, the whole world was watching. Well, I was watching with my mom to see where was Dad.
Where's Dad?
The smoke and all the mayhem.
Yeah.
And I was only 7 years old.
It must have been scary for you.
Scary. Yeah, it was scary. And that whole era was full of scary moments, for sure. But that was a very scary moment, and so I didn't know it, and then the half of it, and then as I researched it, I think that I'll just say that the sense I'm getting of what's going on today and how we got here in terms of militarized police, and you have protesters in cages like thousands of feet away from where the action is taking place. A tepid, milquetoast media that is kowtowing to not lose their access and become, you know, they're like more like stenographers to power. So this is all, I think, sort of caused in a sense by what happened in 68. You had a lot of that was very bad press for sure for the city and for the police department, and they've been making changes ever since.
Yeah, but it had, you know, you got to remember back. I mean, I think at the time most of the American public. It was certainly true of most of the Chicago voting public, said, I'm glad Daley did this. These guys, you know, these are college kids with long hair, and it's such a complicated time. And your dad did a really, I admire him for a number of his books, but also this kind of reportage is very, very difficult. Before I let you go, Niall Southern, and I'll see you when you get into Chicago. I look forward to meeting you. It is living with your dad as you have, as sort of the in charge of his body of work long after his death. Has it given you a deeper? I'm sure it's given you a deeper appreciation of him, but has it given you a deeper understanding of your dad?
It's a great question, and I am continuing to understand him, but myself as well, which I think has become even more pressing at this point. I think I've done a number of books of my father's work as an editor. I also did a book about his book, Candy.
Mm-hmm.
And So I've learned a lot, but I'm continually surprised. I didn't know, for instance, that he was an ROTC cadet through his middle and high school years in Texas.
Yeah.
So here's a kid from Texas who, you know, starts that way. His head is turned around in Paris with the existentialists and the Beats and smoking dope, which he did in Texas, too, as an ROTC cadet, as far as I could tell. So I'm learning a lot about the guy. He's very complex.
Oh,
so
no question.
I think then the goal is not to fully understand him. He would not go for that because he is a surrealist at heart. Anyway, he hated good sense.
Yeah,
but
you're
right. It's really, I think that people coming to this show will understand a lot about these really interesting artists and complex figures, Michael Cooper, Terry Southern, and these complex times, as you said, very complex times. And Michael captures it all, and so does Terry.
You know, I think no one should go to this show. And again, the show is a book and a photo exhibition featuring the works of Terry Southern and Michael Cooper. It's going to take place. Go to the website hatandbread.com, and you'll get a ton of information. It opens Friday.
Hat and Beard, yes.
Hat and Beard, Rick. Hat and Beard.
Let me give you the reference so that you'll remember. It's the first song on Eric Dolphy's 1964 record, Out to Lunch, and it's about Monk. And he's from L.A., and we wanted an L.A. reference when we opened shop. So
it couldn't just be the J.C. Gable Publishing Company. That would be ridiculous. That would be ridiculous. But do not go to this show or buy and read and look at this book for some kind of deeper understanding of these two artists. You can go to this show and this book to simply wallow in their creative power and authority. We got to take a little break. I'll be back in 3 minutes. I have a few more minutes with my old pal, one of the most creative lights this city has ever known, J.C. Gable. I loved his publication, Stop Smiling, as I did his Chicagoan, as I did everything he's ever done. He will be back here with my other guest, Niall Southern, the son of Terry Southern, to talk about and experience a book and photo exhibition featuring the works of Terry Southern and Michael Cooper. We tried to get Michael's son Adam on, but he lives in Buenos Aires or outside of Buenos Aires, and we didn't get him on. But you two, Niall and JC, have been more than articulate and lively. So I thank you both for that. Niall, have you spent much time in Chicago?
Well, we did a play called The Terry Southern Show was with the Prop Theater at the Steppenwolf. Maybe you remember it in 2001, I think. And but that was, I've been off and on since then, but I don't have a strong connection to Chicago. My father went to Northwestern for a time. But I just love Chicago.
Well, you worked with the great Scott Vigil at Prop Theater.
That's right.
The another one and only character and a great guy. Do you think that when you get back, I mean, there is not much to sort of follow in the footsteps of your dad here in that you can't go down to the, you know, amphitheater. You can certainly walk by the Hilton, and you can certainly walk in the park where he witnessed what he witnessed those August nights and days in 1968. Do you plan to do that?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I'm making a film about my father, kind of, you know, a documentary from my perspective. So it's a personal documentary about Terry, and that's one of the ideas of how to resurrect that kind of those scenes. And, you know, one scene in particular, and, you know, it's hard to distill a life into 90 minutes, and how do you cover Chicago 68, you know, within that kaleidoscope. But it's an important story, and I think one vignette I'd like to bring out was what Terry really felt strongly about and what's in the article he wrote for Esquire in 1968, which was the cover story. He wrote about how it was an FBI agent provocateur, as they're known, and who really started the worst of the riots by throwing, as if on cue, a brick through a squad car, giving in a sense the police, you know, license to just go ballistic, which certainly happened and probably happened on more than one occasion. But Terry happened to witness that because he had spent a lot of time in the park with protesters, and he kind of got a sense, certainly, of who was who and who was not who they said they were. And it was not only him, it was others who were more experienced with protests and knowing about infiltration. And but it was clear this buzz, the guy with a buzz cut wearing a Notre Dame T-shirt, or maybe it was the University of Illinois.
Yes, was not a, case, an acolyte of Allen Ginsberg's.
It's one vignette that I thought, well, if I go to the park and find a tree where that's near the street,
you'll find it. You'll find
I'm
it.
Sure.
Niall Sutherland, I look forward to meeting you. J.C. Gable, you know, it's a triumphant return for you, I think, here. I know you've been out in L.A. for about 4 years, but this Head and Bread Press is really something. I mean, you started this in the middle of, you know, what is the most cocked up publishing business in the world, and you were gonna triumph. You really are. You know that, don't you?
I hope so, Rick. I mean, you're far more optimistic than I am.
Well,
I do have faith that people are coming out to more things now. Certainly in the age of Trump, I mean, book sales are up. People are getting off from their screens a little bit, not as much as we probably should.
Well, I think there is a backlash. I think the world has become, in the last 10 years, increasingly icy, the ways in which we all communicate with one another. We don't talk to each other face to face. You know, Twitter is not at all my preferred means of communication. And I think a gathering, as you're going to have on September 14th at 3124 West Carroll at Land and Sea, the book and photo exhibition featuring the work of Terry Southern and Michael Cooper. If you do not, you know, the great thing, Niall, about this is when people come and if this is their first exposure to your dad, watch book sales of not just this book, but every other book of his spike, because he is one of the most intriguing writers of the century, as I said, and he deserves to be much more read than he is currently. I'm sure he sells a number of books, but he is somehow, he hasn't faded away, but I think his books and his reputation needs to be punctuated, and I will do my best at that. Fellas, thank you both
so much.
JC, it's always great to talk to you, and you
an absolute pleasure.
You continue to amaze me, and Niall Sutherland, I look forward to meeting you.
Thank you so much.
Take care, you guys. Take care.
Thanks, Rick.
Anytime. Well, that's it. I am going to, and you can hear it on the podcast tomorrow, interview some people involved deep in the controversy. The city wants to shut down the carriages and the people who ride them and the people who work on the carriages and the horses who pull the carriages. We're going to explore that at length with Jim Rogers, who's owner of Great Lakes Carriage Rides. And I will see you next Sunday. No Bears game.